So I'm afraid I will probably talk only about very elementary things, and also I will talk only very briefly about random stuff, I suppose. But let's see where we're getting. So maybe even for a Blackboard talk, I should give you some kind of outline. So what I want to start with are some very elementary things on norms, on states and group operators. Then I just want to talk about a little bit about statistical or information theoretical interpretation of these norms. Then we'll see how long I take for this. A couple of examples, actually, and calculations that you can do with this. Then, four, I want to talk about really the subject in the dimension of the title, this information erasure, that I would call, in this context, almost constant super operators. And then, five is a particular duality between properties of the channel. Well, when I say channel, I usually mean completely positive superoperator, but okay, we get to that. So the norms I want to introduce, or that I want to discuss, have been used extensively in quantum information. So there's the first thing, okay, a bit of notation. A is for me, and capital letters like A, B, C, so on, these are Hilbert spaces. And I use the Yard convention to denote this as the dimension of A. It should be finite so that we can actually talk about matrices, basically, and vectors and matrices. But I mean, okay, obviously it helps to have some notation for the names of the Hilbert spaces. So these are simply the operators, or the matrices, if you want, on A. Okay, so this space here has a number of norms that make it into a Banach space, and one of my favorite norms is the trace norm. So this is for rho, an element of this. But this doesn't have to be Hermitian or even positive. We call it the one norm, the non-commutative one norm. It's the trace of the absolute value of rho. So that's the trace of root rho delta. And for Hermitian or for diagonalizable rho, from this formula, you see this is simply the sum of the absolute values of all the arguments. So this makes this space into a Banach space, except for norm. And that means that for maps between such spaces, so if we have a linear map, let's call it N, from L of A to some L of B, and this is what we usually like to call a super operator. This inherits a natural norm, right? Because we have two norm spaces here. So it's the norm of the linear map regarding both of these here as spaces with this one norm. So, and I think some people they use notation like this here. The one-to-one norm of such an N is simply the sup of all rho norm of N of rho under the choice of norm. I mean, there is also a one norm here divided by rho 1. Yeah, a bit stupid now that I have these two moving boards. Okay. I guess I go along and I delete things that I don't need anymore.
Is it equivalent to the one-to-one norm? Is the equivalent definition to just take the one norm, not divide it, but restrict to operators of norm equal to one?
Oh, yeah, of course. Because, I mean, these are norms, right? So they are homogeneous, I mean, multiplicative. Yeah, so this is the same as this soup when I fix norm rho equal to one. Yeah. Okay, so I just wanted to put it like this because, I mean, from this you can see it. I mean, this is just a general comparison of norms, basically. I mean, this is, of course, how you do it for matrices, for example. This is how you introduce the matrix norm, because the matrices, these guys here, they act on the Hilbert space elements. And for Hilbert space elements, you have the two norm, the Euclidean norm, and you define the operator norm exactly this way. Anyhow, this one-to-one norm somehow turns out to be not quite so nice as we would like it, and one of the reasons is that it's not multiplicative in the following sense. Right. So not multiplicative. In general, the norm of a tensor product strictly larger, and larger equal to strictly, usually strictly larger than the product of the norms. Which you will realize, this is an equality for a matrix norm like this one here, and also for the largest eigenvalue. And that's why we go to the completion, and it's a there's a kind of a generic process in such a setting that you define n, and I use quantum information parlance here, diamond, as simply the soup of n tensors with the identity on n by n matrices, so this is an n, of this one-to-one. Right? So this guy here is actually multiplicative. Exactly, because of that. It's just the typographical symbol. But of course, yeah, I mean, that's what I want to just say. I mean, it's simply the completion of this norm. That's one way of understanding. I deliberate a little bit about this, and I want to distinguish it. Eventually, I want to distinguish it from what operator people would call the CD norm, because that is the completion of the infinite norm.
Non-normalized.
So the trace of the identity matrix is the dimension of the space. Okay. This is just mathematics, and from this definition here, of course, we are not motivated to introduce another family, a whole family of norms. We could also want to give names to. This is simply the n diamond with a superscript little n. Actually, it's idea that n is not that big. You can't distinguish between small and big n. So let's call it K. And that is simply the norm of N tensors with the identity on K by K matrices, the one-to-one norm. So it's clear that the one-to-one norm, this is simply, it's just another name for this diamond with a 1 here, so the tensor with 1 by 1 matrix, and nothing happens. And then they are increasing because of the way this maximization is defined. Diamond, and so on, up to, actually, it turns out, diamond norm of dimension A. And this is equal to the supremum. So for this one, you have to prove something, obviously, that it doesn't increase anymore, but it's easy. So these are all these norms that I want to discuss. And you might wonder, so why does he introduce all these different norms? Because after all, the spaces we're talking about are finite. I mean, it's finite. I mean, I insisted already. The Hilbert space is finite, or maybe it's a finite dimension. So norms, if they're norms or equivalent. But of course, there is still an interesting geometrical question then, which is, what is the constant of comparison? So for these simple norms here, so I want to just claim a little lemma that provides the comparison between these norms and superoperators. So in this case, we have the diamond norm of order k is less than or equal, as I said before, the diamond norm of order l. But there is a matching upper bound, L over K, diamond norm. Yeah, so this is interesting, for example, for L over K boundary. You will notice that there is no mention of the underlying Hilbert space or matrix space dimension. So in that sense, This is, in that sense, even though trivially on any finite dimension space all the norms are equivalent, this is an equivalent statement that is uniform, that does not refer to the matrix dimension. These kind of things are usually quite useful. I guess the mathematicians, they like it because you can make statements about infinite families of Hilbert spaces, you can make certain constructions. For us, this is interesting because the dimension usually has something to do with an underlying information theoretical limit. And a little remark I want to make, just a small one, because it was something that was driven home to me through conversation with Aram. Most of these norms, we don't know very much about them, and there is a good reason for that. We understand very well this norm here, the trace norm, and we also understand pretty well the diamond norm, this completely bounded norm. And the reason in both cases is that we have very useful formulas for them. They are computable in a deep sense. So this one is clear, we just need the eigenvalues. And for the diamond norm, John Bottrus has shown that this can be calculated as a semi-different program, at least when n is Hermitian preserved, which is not a big restriction. But all the others, these superscript k ones, presumably they are not efficiently computable, but we don't know this. Okay, so then a few words about the statistical interpretation. What makes these norms interesting for people with an information theoretical or statistical background? So the trace norm occurs in the following game that is called state discrimination. So I guess it's useful to think of it as a game. For someone, your adversary prepares one of two states, rho or sigma. So now these are supposed to be states, I think. So this means they should be positive semi-definite in trace 1 and with equal probability. And your task is to measure the system on which the state is prepared and make a guess which of the two states it is. And depending on what the states are, of course, you will be more or less likely to succeed, to say it is the first or the second state. I mean, in the limiting case, for example, they might be equal, and there's no physical grounds for even distinguishing them. So it's clearly with probability half you make an error. And then I guess we usually attribute this to Hellstrom, the minimum error probability over all measurements. of all such measurement strategies. I don't want to formalize this here. This is equal to an expression that only involves the trace function. So that is our justification for calling this also the statistical distance between states. And likewise, if we do a game of channel discrimination, well, we have to think a little bit what the game is supposed to be, but I give you first of all what the minimum error probability is. So, and here we have to think about what kind of strategies we'll have to consider as a natural class of strategies of distinguishing two channels, so we call them N and M. And now I want them to be completely positive and trace preserving to cooperate. This only to make it physically feasible, because I will have to motivate this class of strategies here. This is 1/2, 1 minus 1/2 of the diamond norm difference. So it should be noted that this thing here really can, this difference here is a superoperator, not necessarily positive, but Hermitian preserving. And if these guys are trace preserving, then the difference has norm at most 2. Follow from the triangle. So the minimum, all the strategies that you can consider here are simply in the context of a game where the adversary somehow gives us a black box that somehow inside is a system that performs the challenge. So the strategies, I probably just draw some kind of circuit diagram. Here's the black box. It contains either N or M. Of course, to make it a non-trivial question, we cannot distinguish the boxes by just looking at the ports. They must actually act on the same input and output system. And we reduce it to this problem here by simply saying, okay, we can choose what we put into the box. But we have a bit of more freedom. Actually, we can choose a state on a bipartite system. We can put a probe state tau here. So this is a density operator. And outcomes, well, something that somehow the channel acts only on part of the system of tau and leaves the rest alone. So we get some kind of N or M cancelled with an identity acting on tau. And then we have reduced it to a state determination problem, and we want to maximize the trace distance between these two states over all tau. And turns out this is exactly the diamond norm. So this gives a statistical interpretation to this diamond norm, again as a statistical distance. It's directly related to the guessing probability of identifying the channel correctly. I should say, yeah, so it's to talk about these probabilities, of course, it's necessary to introduce this assumption the adversary chooses the two with probability 50-50. That's somehow affecting the formula, but let's not get into this. Let me point out that for this to be true, it is actually crucial that we have access to this, that we have access to strategies where we can prepare test states that are correlated between the input port and some auxiliary system. So let's say this is n-dimensional Hilbert space, then here are n by n matrices. And of course you can see where this is going. Also these diamond K norms have a similar statistical interpretation. When I, in the scenario where we speak this here, indeed the minimum error probability over all strategies with k-dimensional ancilla. So that's this kind of thing here. this is equal to half 1 minus a half n minus n k diamond. No. Yeah, so in that sense, this chain of inequalities up there, it reflects on the level of a statistical game that two transformations on state, two of these channels, can become more and more distinguishable. Because the norm is getting larger, the error probably gets smaller because of this minus one. They become more and more distinguishable if you are able to prepare probe states that are actually correlated between the actual input of your channel and another thing. So far so good. Well, let's see. This was, I hope, elementary enough for most of you. So I want to discuss a little bit a few examples to see that these norms are not entirely trivial objects. So, for example, for positive semidefinite row and trace, for positive semidefinite row, the trace norm of row is simply the trace. So, in particular for states, this would be 1. Similarly, if n, no, this doesn't matter really. If n is completely positive and trace preserving, then the diamond norm can take all the k diamond norms are equal to 1. So this is some kind of normalization condition. And of course, we need an example to see that this complete positivity is necessary. So we consider, for example, E is the transpose map. The transpose of a matrix is, of course, a linear map. Once you choose the basis of the Hilbert space, then it's well defined. And then it turns out that E diamond on A K is equal to K for 1 less than equal to K less than equal to the dimension of K. And it's A if K is not a one. So actually, the other need is because the norm doesn't change. So we see that that these norms actually are very different on general superoperators, and also we see that both of these inequalities here are attainment equalities, so they cannot be improved without any further knowledge of the channel. Okay, so that's the mathematical part. So I want to use these channels to compare. So I want to use these norms now to compare channels. So I want to evaluate these norms always on differences of two completely positive trace preserving maps. And one of them is a constant. So this is the subset of almost constant map. Let's say channel. So first of all, maybe I should introduce this. For sigma naught and a state on D, we write by a slight abuse of notation, sigma naught identified as with a channel that goes from A to B. And it takes rho to trace of rho times sigma naught. And particularly if rho is a state, then all the states rho are mapped to sigma naught. So that's what I call a constant channel. And a small remark that if I have two states, then of course I have the trace distance between them, and the trace number is different. This is then under this notation of course, sigma naught and sigma naught prime are also channels, and then this is equal to the diamond. But, so this is just to show you that the Abusov notation is not so bad. Okay, so now I have to start erasing again, I suppose. So almost constant channels simply will mean that, okay, I want to consider channels, I want to understand what are the channels that are close to such objects here under one of those norms. Okay, so I guess I took a rather long introduction. Well, that's also true. Yes, yeah, that's true. Okay. So, and I want to, I mean, basically, I don't know how far I will get with this. I mean, probably the duality I have to meet. I want to discuss basically two classes of such constant or almost constant channels, and one of them is random unitary channels. So these are objects of the following form. So n x goes from one operator space to itself. N of one row is simply a complex combination of computations by u I. So complex combination is either positive or zero, one, and u I is a unitary. I mean, there is no statistic here. The random refers to this here.
So this is the part, this channel is a I call random unitary if you can imagine this. So such channels, I mean, first of all, they are contenders because this class contains actually constant channels. Of course, you will, if you think about this, because the unitary is the only constant independent pair over there, must be the maximum mixed state, one over the dimension times the identity. Such objects here, A, B, going from 0 to B minus 1, this was not very consistent, E is equal to A. So where these X and Z are suitably defined discrete while operators, so they shift this state in a standard and Fourier transform synthesis. So this is always equal to, but if you want a trace of rho, of course, times one over the identity. So a small thing I want to mention is then so are there others, and in particular are there other chances that are approximately constant in the sense of these norms, and so I want to discuss basically two extreme cases.
Because clearly of these diamond norms, there is the largest one and the smallest one. So for these two diamond observations. I want to, so this is the first case, is we want the channel to be constant, and we know already what the constant is, it's just 1 over d here, in the completely bounded norm. And from this statistical interpretation, you know this occurs as a maximum over all choices of test states of trace distance. So in particular, I can choose a particular test state, namely the maximally entangled state, that we also saw before in various talks. or this would be n minus the constant tensor with the identity on B, and this acting on ID. And of this we want to trace now. Now, both of these terms here and these individual terms you can evaluate, and it's like this, it's a phase distance of Ci, Ui, identity, this, ID. So this is the first one. So this, I'm trying to analyze a generic object of this form. And over here, this is simply minus 1 over d squared identity, tensor identity. So I'm pedantic here, these are both d by d identities. And this would be very small, right? So that means this guy here has to be almost equal to the suitably normalized identity matrix in the tracing. And so there are two things that follow from this. I mean, the first one is that the number of indices that you have to get here, that's the rank of this object. This rank must be at least comparable to this here, otherwise you won't have a chance of making the traces as large. This is at least as large as d squared times 1 minus epsilon. And in fact, you can be even more precise if you want using entropy inequalities. Instead of counting the non-zero terms here, we can actually poly characterize the entropy of P. This is larger or equal to 1 minus for the epsilon log P squared. And so these two things, they don't reduce to each other properly, unfortunately, but in a certain weak sense, you can think of this as a generalization, right? I mean, when you take the log here, this is a very coarse approximation to the entropy, and then you get log D squared over here. Okay, so that means that this particular way of writing the constant channel is essentially optimal, because we have here d squared terms, and the entropy is equal to 2 log d. Log d for each of these random indices a and d. So in a certain sense, this means that as long as we're interested, for example, in minimizing the number of terms here, there is not much we can do if we insist on, if we use as a distance measure the Diamond norm, which of course prepares the ground for looking at the one norm, the Diamond one norm. Okay, so I hope we will do this. So, okay, let's do it for all k straight away, because I'm, so so for this one here, we do the same basically. Maybe I do it actually. I will do it here. So let's just do the k here. Yeah? So then, of course, I'm not allowed to tensor with an identity of d by d. The maximum I can do is a k here, and I can put a rank k maximum in tensor space. Now, this is not necessarily unique anymore, but actually it doesn't really matter which one I choose. I just pick one of them. Just pick your favorite basis and write maximum tensor state. And then let's be a bit precise here. Then this identity here is the identity acting on this space. It's the k by k identity matrix. And here I have d and here I have k. So that means now that the number of terms is lower bounded essentially by dk. Just by looking at the rank. And similarly, I get a lower bound that looks like this here. The entropy is, so it's a bit of a more uniform measure again. It's essentially log dk of randomness at n. So for k less than d, and especially for k equal to 1, there is now an optimality question. And this is a little thing I want to I want to mention briefly at least. So this is a theorem that is, I think in this form it's essentially due to Guillaume Auguin. Even I think he formulated only for k equal 1, but it's clear that it can be generalized for arbitrary k. So there exists n equal to some universal constant of epsilon squared dk u I in the unitary of d by d, such that for channel n is the convex combination or the equally weighted convex combination of these lines. N minus this constant channel in the appropriate first norm is less than equal to.
So
the proof of this is, I guess I should refrain from going into the proof of this. So the way you show this existence in any case is to pick U1 all the way up to UN IID from the Hall measure. And then, of course, we use general tools for measure concentration. I think, in fact, all you need is Levy's lemma for this. So this is measure concentration on some big sphere. And then another thing is some norm tools, let's say. Because you see, we want to approximate a norm here, and that makes life a little bit easier. So this is inspired by Voretsky, and I say this word only without any further explanation because I see that we have a talk in the workshop anyway the day after tomorrow. So this is your cliffhanger for Sazerstein. If you want to learn a bit about Voretsky. So it means this kind of lower bound is almost tight. I mean, of course, the constant factor is very poor. Right here, I have a 1 minus epsilon. Over there, I have an epsilon in the denominator, and I have some potential big constant, but the constant is a constant of nature. I think Guillaume says it's maybe 150. Okay. But anyway, I mean, these kind of things we consider usually as constant. The asymptotic parameters are E and P, and K, maybe. Okay, so let me see what I can do in the remaining 2 minutes. Huh? 5. Yeah. Okay. I can stop any place anyway. Okay, now I really have to erase something.
The problem is they want to erase it in a complete norm, so it's really the same thing. So I want to talk about another class of examples. I mean, this is somehow a limited class of examples, and I didn't even talk about applications of this.
One application of this is evidently in constructions to violate additivity, but it's not the best possible one. There are a couple of other constructions for simulating certain quantum channels by simpler channels, let's say. I don't know if they prefer this for the people who heard about this one. I think it's not very necessary to go into this. I mean, it's interesting enough to see that these norms somehow also have a significance in the as a kind of a degree of obliteration. So the other class of channels I would like to discuss is time stream channels. And really, these are all channels. So I want you to think about them in a particular way. So we fix a substrate in a bipartite group. And with some projector, ER onto R. And I guess I have to introduce the state corresponding to this reduced on trace over 1 over R in type C similarly. So I want to consider channels where I have here, where I pick an isometry from some A into R at random. So I want to show that, I want to convince you that such channels, so this of course gives rise to a channel N of rho, that is, well, V rho V vega, and then a trace of C of Z. So this goes from A to B. I want to convince you that such channels also can be approximately random, at least in the diamond one norm. Sorry, approximately constant in the diamond one norm. The statement is like this. I think I just have time to say it. So interestingly, it has only to do with properties of these two states. Yeah. So this is something that is in some form stated in a paper I wrote with Patrick Hayden. So if theta is the following number, it's the rank of pi b times the trace of pi c squared. And the dimension of A is, somehow much, much smaller. It's of the order B over epsilon squared dimension of R. So again, this constant here, depending on what your idea of epsilon is, this is a universal constant, again, like the one over there. This looks like very small, but of course, if you think of R as the big number, then this is just some prefactor. So in a certain sense, a large fraction of the Hilbert space has this property. Then for random isometry here, so again, this is according to Horn measure on R, there's a probability that N deviates from, well, what is it? The constant channel is going to be this one here, pi B, in one norm by more than epsilon plus delta. So this goes to zero. That's the dimension store. And there is some exponential law that governs this, which I don't want to write down because I'm already over the time. So what this means, I mean, just to interpret this a little bit. First of all, it gives us access to a huge number of rather surprising, almost constant channels. Because I put a priori no restriction here on these subspaces. Of course, what I need is that this number delta here is small, right? So there is some condition on these two reduced states that implicitly excludes certain subspaces. But even if it does, then usually the other way around, if I swap B and C, it will work. So I can just pick pretty much any subspace here. And then this is a huge subspace, or in fact, most subspaces, if I restrict the embedding to this slightly smaller bit, have the property that the corresponding channel here is almost constant, at least in the one norm sense. I say this to emphasize that this is not true in the completely bounded diamond sense, because we classify them pretty much in this case. These are much, much easier to classify the completely bounded almost constant one. These are really surprising guys. And they actually play a role in, counterexamples to additivity, at least in the ones that, Patrick Hayden discovered. And I think to some degree you can also interpret the Hastings examples for non-additivity of the for Neumann output entropy in this setting. Even though then you need much, much tighter bounds than this. This is why I'm sorry, on Tuesday we have, I think, some like three talks on non-additivity. Okay, I think I better stop here without telling you about duality, but I'm around, so you can ask me later.
Just a comment. Yes. For special choices of random unitaries taken from a group, these differences have been calculated. There is an explicit expression which you should evaluate. That's work by Wilhelm. I mean, if you take in your examples these PIs with the unitaries. So if the unitaries are nicely chosen, for instance, coming from a finite group,
yes,
and this difference has a very nice.
Yeah, I mean this connects to Lorenzo's talk, of course. This, I mean, these are then projections onto certain subalgebras.
This formula is different. You have to use a little bit. You have to use a little bit theory of locally finite groups, just right. I mean.
So which work are you talking about?
This is the work by Neufunk and Strong, I think. About, I mean, you will not recognize it. They call it A of G and the mapping from A of G and the CD maps of blah, blah, blah. So the point is just, it is exactly the same thing, but the terminology is different. So.
Yes, yes.
Some more questions? If not, I think we deserve a coffee break and we'll meet here 3:30.